Hello, I'm Danny Aiken, president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. We want to thank you for listening to this chapel message. Our mission at Southeastern is to seek to glorify the Lord Jesus Christ by equipping students to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. We hope that you enjoy this chapel message and that you will visit our website. It's www.sebts.edu. There you can learn more about our school and what the Lord is doing here. We hope you enjoy the message. Thank you for being a part of what we're doing here.
Wow, great to be here. I echo the feelings of the others being honored that we're asked here, and also that the whole conference is set up to draw attention to the work of Francis Schaeffer and what he's done, and that being a very important and helpful thing. We've heard about Schaeffer the man. We've heard about Schaeffer's apologetics. We've heard about Schaeffer's views into the 20th century. And we've heard last night about his contribution to evangelicalism. What is left? Well, as Bruce and I were discussing this some months ago, we were wondering, should we just expand one of these categories or not? And we worked out together, well, maybe we should do something on what's happening in LaBrie now. What sort of things are we doing now in LaBrie that continue this vision? So I'm actually not going to talk about Schaeffer at all this morning. I'm just going to pick up a theme that, just as an example, actually I had a very hard time deciding what to talk about of all the different things that are both important and interesting. And as an example of what I'm trying to do, for example, today, continuing something of this vision. That's not at all saying this is what Francis Schaeffer would be saying now if he was standing here. I have no idea what he'd be saying now. Well, some idea. But I'm just going to launch off on, okay, what's going on now and what does it look like if we try and take some of these broad notions and look around us today. Dr. Schaeffer challenged the church and also wonderfully helped the church to connect with the non-church, to connect with secular society, with confidence and humility rather than just bombast combat. Especially important, I think, was his work to let's understand this culture, and that's going to take some work. That's going to take some effort. That's not going to happen like that. If it happens like that, we will have knee-jerk responses in a thousand directions, and which we've seen enough of and which has been peculiarly unfruitful. And so you see in his work a lot of study. Let's really get into and understand what is going on in the culture around us, and particularly focusing on or spending time with and having an ear the grievances of non-Christian people, the grievances that they have at the church, at us. And the blocks that they bring against the church and against Christ. I've decided to just pick something that to me has been intriguing, and particularly because I don't think it's been noted enough by Christians. I'm going to speak about sentimentality as an unidentified threat to Christ, the church, and the faith. May seem a strange concern, but it's actually a very important thing for Christians to start to think about and wake up on. It's been the background for both a lot of what Ranald and Udo have said. But I think it needs to be tackled directly. I got into this because I'd written another book about cynicism. And if you thought much about cynicism, the cynic and the sentimentalist are sworn enemies. These are sort of opposite poles. Cynicism sees only what is corrupt and worthy of suspicion. Sentimentality doesn't see anything to be suspicious about. Oscar Wilde said that sentimentality is what happens when the cynic goes on a bank holiday. And sentimentality presents two serious kinds of problems for Christians and for Christian apologetics. First, insofar as Christians have become sentimental, and in my view, been corrupted by and seduced by sentimentality, that is a reliable turnoff to non-Christian people sincerely, honestly seeking for the truth. That leads non-Christian people to look at the church and say, well, I won't find the truth there. Because if they look and they see sentimentality, they'll turn and they'll look away. And that's an encouragement to cynicism. So it is what I've called, and I think when I teach this course next time in cultural apologetics, I'm going to have a whole section called negative apologetics, meaning that's a phrase I've heard before, but I can use it in a different way, meaning the things that Christians do that make their faith hard to believe by the non-Christian world. Not just the true things we believe that they find difficult to believe, but the screw-ups, the things that we bungle and get wrong that's in the Bible, and by bungling and getting it wrong, make it very, very hard for non-Christians to identify. And I would put sentimentality in that category. So this is the first thing. Sentimentality, insofar as it's infiltrated our ranks, can cause a major turnoff by sincere and honest people looking for truth. Secondly, is that for non-Christian people who are sentimental, for non-Christian people who are themselves sentimental, they will see no need for Jesus Christ as the Bible frames him. They will have lots of built-in filters and barriers to Jesus. Now, I'm going to define sentimentality, which may be narrower, more narrowly than you are used to using it. Bear with me. But what I have to define it fairly specifically in order to get away with saying the things I'm going to say and have it hold together. I'll be using some categories by I found very helpful in the work of a guy called Jeremy Begbie, a theologian and musician. He points to three elements of sentimentality. I'll give them to you very quickly here, and then I'll be going back to them several times over as we go through this talk. One, sentimentality frames the world without sin, evil, brokenness, ugliness, cruelty, complexity, or confusion. These things are denied and trivialized. It's a world of niceness and warmth, harmony, and simplicity. Two, sentimentality includes self-referential emotion. That's going to be harder to get a hold of, but I'm going to spend a lot of time on it in a few minutes. Self-referential emotion. It is a turning of the feelings back on themselves, feeling about yourself feeling. I'll try and make this clear as we go. Example, someone is in... Two people say they're in love if they're sentimentalist in the sense that I'm talking about. There's a strong dose in which what they see as love for the other person is actually love for their own feelings about the other person. We'll come back to that. Third, sentimental emotions do not result in responsible action or appropriate response. If there's no significant evil in the world, if my emotions are mainly self-referential, what's the need to act out into the world, and particularly to do anything costly into the world, anything difficult, anything upstream or uphill into the world? So sentimental emotions distract us, can anesthetize us, and keep us from any sort of response, particularly if it's inconvenient and difficult. Now, that's the nature of sentimentality as I'm going to be speaking about it. Those three things frame a kind of a twisted coherence of each one feeding the other. Now, you can have one or two or whatever of these elements, and so you have all sorts of different variants, and so it gets very complicated if you try to get precise. But my point is that sentimentality is not just found in Hallmark cards or in 1930s and 1940s films. It's all over the place in modern society and all around us, and unhappily, far too much of it in the church. Okay, I'm going to go through each of these things again in much more thoroughness. What is the mark of sentimentality in our society? Okay, now, this is going to be straight description. I'm going to try and get to expound each of those three elements for you. First, denial, evasion, or trivializing of evil and brokenness. Sentimentality is threatened by seeing evil straight, its danger, its ugliness, its cruelty, its emptiness. Sentimentalists are averse to the idea that all people have a natural capacity to do wrong, to do evil, a predisposition even to do evil. That threatens their dreams of the past, their dreams of the present and the future. Sentimentality sees through a lens of innocence to a utopia of niceness. Denial of sin is not hard to do when you have a big range of choice of what comes into your mind, of choice of what you want to look at, what you want to listen to. It makes self-deception very easy. I think of the role of the internet, the role of basically IT technology here, in being able, in our ability to control what comes into our brain. It's profound how much we can exert control about what comes into our heads. One, in the literature about cynicism, one of the classic examples, about sentimentality. One of the classic examples people go back to is from several generations ago, the nature of Nazi propaganda devised by Goebbels in the 1930s. He had a very conscious approach to music played on the radio, which was not, as you might have thought, militaristic marches, Wagner, and so on, but it was day after day, sweet, syrupy love songs. Day after day, afternoon, morning, afternoon, evening, year after year, as Hitler was turning their country into a police state built on a racist nightmare. What better distraction? Who would have thought? You read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and that's a dystopia based not on fear, on the great dictator ruling by fear, but it's ruling by pleasure and ruling by sentimentality, by endless sentimental cliches and upbeat slogans and an elaborate conditioning so that no one was exposed to anything upsetting in life. And so in complete control. And as many people have said, Brave New World is a much better script for what had happened than 1984. Which was all about fear. Brave New World comes much closer to the nature of the modern world than a fear-based utopia or dystopia. Media sentimentality is vast. I'm not going to be able to get into the role of sentimentality in advertising, but that would be a whole another lecture itself. But it starts early. Children are told by Barney that the world is wonderful, that everybody loves them, and that they can have what they want by wishing for it. Now, is that what you want your children to grow up with? The world is wonderful, everybody loves them, and you can have what you want by wishing for it. It's nice, it's wonderful, it's happy. Hey, we want our kids to be happy. But something profoundly wrong in that. Everything profoundly wrong in fact. But we need the eyes to see that. Udo yesterday mentioned Walt Disney, and he'd be very much in this direction. One scholar puts it this way. Walt Disney's given us a world without dirt, cruelty, or complexity. And I would add also without God or church, but with lots of niceness, simplicity, optimism, and superb marketing. If you've watched any recent public television fundraising programs, you may have seen a concert. They always bring on musicians that they think the old folks, the baby boomers, will remember and have them have concerts, and it's all a big nostalgia time. But they did a whole concert on sort of a retrospective on the career of James Taylor. I don't want to evaluate him as a singer-songwriter here, especially he's a native North Carolina dude, so I don't want to say anything one way or the other about it. But they did this whole concert. He did this whole concert, a live concert, or it was a filming of a concert, and it was building up to, at the end, you knew it was announced at the beginning, it was building up to, he's going to sing Fire and Rain, which is his song that was number 3 in 1970, But you can still hear today in dentist offices, in airports, in elevators. Today, 38 years later, it's all over the place. Okay? It's a song about the suicide of a good friend, about heroin addiction, withdrawal, clinical depression, and several hospitalizations, and the collapse of the dreams of his dreams for his career. When he sings it in this concert that I'm thinking of, that was about a year and a half ago, he was singing it with this huge, broad grin. The crowd was out there grinning and swaying and arm in arm. Ah, yes, the old times. Suicide, drug addiction, hospitalization, depression. Yeah. It was this amazing nostalgia bath. But a complete disconnection, you see, for the lyrics of the words that you're hearing about and the reality of the situation. Sentimentality can cover anything. Can cover anything. Filter out anything. And here, I thought this is a high point of musical sentimentality for someone who's even the king of airport music. So it's comforting, soothing, positive. How many people, and I could put some Christians in this category, I'm afraid, make an intentional diet of stories in film or print that they read or see because they know they have impossibly unrealistic happy endings. And that's their whole diet. That's a restrictive diet. And that means I don't want to be troubled. I don't want to know really about what's broken in me, what's broken in my neighbor, and what's broken in the world. It's a self-induced self-deception. I've even known a person who had what she called the pink cloud theory of evil. And it was she could visualize evil, something the matter, something painful in the world, and she would put it in the sky, and she would bring on in her mind a pink cloud, which would swallow it up like a paramecium or whatever, and enclose it in itself and blow it away. A strong wind would come, and the pink cloud would blow away, and she could surgically remove it from her consciousness. And again, there's an amazing power we can have to self-deceive. Okay, that's the first part. A denial of evil, a trivialization of evil, a euphemizing of evil and sin and all that is broken. Self-referential emotion. This is a little bit trickier to get a hold of. But the British philosopher Roger Scruton puts it this way. He says, sentimentality is that peculiar human vice which consists in directing your emotions toward your emotions so as to be the subject story told by yourself. Now, it's abstract, but you get the picture. Good example. it basically is what looks like feelings for other people really have me as their object again and again. An intriguing example of this is Tennyson's famous poem In Memoriam, one of the great poems of the 19th century. It's in virtually almost all anthologies of British poetry that cover the 19th century. It's a long, long poem. It's 40 to 50 pages, when many of the other poems in similar anthologies cover half a column of one page. It's a poem about the death of a very close friend, the tragic death of a man called Arthur Hallam, died at age 22 years old. He was both a friend of Tennyson and a sort of a literary counselor. Spent a lot of time with Tennyson talking about what he was writing. And also at the same time, he was the fiancé of Tennyson's sister. He died tragically. This is a poem about this. But it's remarked again and again that in this long poem, almost nothing is said about Arthur Hallam. You don't learn anything about the man who died. It's a poem about Tennyson's struggle. It's all about him. It's about his struggles of faith. It's about his feelings, his emotions. Nothing is said about the man who died. It's his grief, his suffering, his trials of faith. It's almost entirely self-referential. Another more contemporary example that is in many people's literature who write about sentimentality is Princess Diana's funeral. Millions of people, deeply moved, mountains of flowers measured in the ton. There were tons of flowers in mountains banked in different, Buckingham Palace and so on all over London. Thousands of interviews. People were desperately wanted to talk about what they were feeling and talk about what was going on. Some of you would have been around then and may remember it. But the fascinating thing about the interviews is that what people wanted to talk about was their own feelings about her death. Her death was something that had happened to them. Now, think about that. Her death is something that had happened to them. That was the urgent thing. They wanted to talk about how it made them feel. If some of you have seen the Helen Mirren film, The Queen, you see the way this completely confounds the stoical royal family. They don't have the faintest clue what's going on with this media-driven public sentimentality that's out there. They are mystified by it. After working on cynicism, I have more sympathy with the royal family than I did when I first watched the film, because people describe now this phenomenon called conspicuous compassion. That this means it's compassionate, but you're compassionate in public in ways that other people are compassionate too. And you express and they express, and there's a togetherness here. A pleasure in the public demonstration and display of sorrow and strong emotion. People talk about the buzz of being able to cry on TV makes people feel good about themselves and also connected to other people crying on TV for the same reason. An experience of real connection with other people in this way. We live in a society where everything is scripted. Think of the world of politicians and celebrities, and where every word, every move is scripted and spun. I think of as long ago as the Beatles' first trip to the United States in 1960, whatever it was, they had contracts signed that no photograph of them would be released that didn't go through their manager first. In their whole tour of the United States, no one was allowed to release any photograph except that went through the office of their publicity. That was in 1960, what, 1, 2, 3 or something like that. But that's the world we live in. A high degree of spin and control of information. That's why journalists get so excited if a politician or public figure is found to say things after the mic was turned off, and he didn't know the mic wasn't turned off. He didn't know the mic was on. And so everybody gets very excited to find somebody speaking because you think, maybe now I'll get the real thing. I'll get what he really thinks or what she really thinks. And so people get all excited about that. And in this world of spin and prior scripting, we like to think, well, it's our own emotions, it's our deepest feelings that are spontaneous, free, authentic, and uniquely our own. Now, those who write about sentimentality will say, not so fast, not so fast. Don't you see that our sentimentalized society teaches you also what to feel? It teaches you what to feel. It teaches you what you need to feel in order to feel good about yourself. If you feel this way, then it's okay to feel good about yourself. So all sorts of social pressures on us script what we're meant to be feeling in order to feel adequate or proper. And I'm thinking of a couple of different books, one called Faking It, by Anderson and Mullen, another, The Post-Emotional Society, by Mestrovic. Mestrovic argues that our real and authentic emotions are there still, but they're buried under feelings that we feel we are meant to feel in whatever situation we're in. Even though so much emphasis is put on emotion in our society, he would say we are in a post-emotional society because our real emotions are pretty well buried under there. Or Roger Scruton again cites T.S. Eliot, where he claims that sentimentality causes us not merely to write in cliches, but to feel in cliches too, lest we be troubled by the truth of our condition. D.H. Lawrence has one of the classic descriptions of sentimentalism. I'll read it to you. Sentimentalism is the rough on yourself of feelings you haven't really got. We all want to have certain feelings, feelings of love, passionate sex, of kindliness, and so forth. Very few people really feel love or sex, passion, or kindliness, or anything else that goes all that deep. So the mass just fake these feelings inside themselves. Faked feelings, The world is all gummy with them. They are better than real feelings because you can spit them out when you brush your teeth, and then tomorrow you can fake them afresh. Well, you're getting the sense of what I'm talking about self-referential emotion here. There's something really quite complicated going on. Now I'm going to get into some difficulty talking about sentimentality and the arts and kitsch. So I can probably not avoid offending people because you can't go very far down this road before you get into taste issues and where those begin and end. I'm mystified, but let me start with the most basic. Most lawn ornaments are kitsch. Maybe not all, but most lawn ornaments are kitsch. I'm really going to try hard to play it safe here, but I'd be safe. The classic kitsch icon is a plastic pink flamingo. I have one. I was going to bring it, but my suitcase isn't quite big enough. We have one in our Le Brie art collection in Massachusetts. A pink flamingo with wire legs. You can stick it on the lawn. You've seen them. That is classic kitsch. Velvet Elvis portraits are kitsch. Velvet portraits of John Wayne, Dale Earnhardt, or Jesus are all also considered kitsch. Paintings in motel lobbies of waifs with enormous eyes are kitsch. Some, and this is where I would say, some would consider the paintings of Thomas Kincaid to be kitsch. Let me quickly go beyond that. Some of the elements of kitsch. I hear different ideas about its background. It seems to come from a certain German dialect verb originally meant to scrape manure and mud off from the street. It's started to be used in the 1860s and 70s in Munich, though, to describe cheesy, slapped-together attempts at art sold cheap to those who didn't know any better but who wanted a false sense of their own sophistication because we own art. Okay? That's a long sentence, but you get the drift. Mass-produced, quick and easy, give it to people, sell it to them and tell them it's art, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I've got art. It came to be used in English in the 30s, a lot of debate in neo-Marxist aesthetics and so on, and really interesting discussion. The form of kitsch is that it's apt to be mass-produced, poor quality, a shallow substitute for art, driven by the needs of the market. It's commercial, cliched, and it's designed to provide an emotional uplift and the illusion of social connection, warmth, and niceness. The content, of course, is that it's kitsch is sentimental. It tries to help you fake an emotion that is not really earned. It does not deal with the serious thought or reflection, either by the artist or the viewer. It doesn't challenge or stretch us. It gives us a cheapened comfort, a sense of warm feelings and niceness. It's what people produce when they're interested in doing something to do with beauty, but nothing to do with truth. No room for complexity or contradiction or real sin or evil. Again, just think about this in terms of the world of advertising and the power there. Okay, I've talked about denial of evil. I've talked about self-referential emotion. Now, emotion without appropriate response and costly response. It's a famous story from the Victorian era from London. I'm not sure. It might have even been, some of you may know where it comes from, actually, from Dickens or someone. A gentleman and his wife go to the theater in London on a very cold evening where it's snowy. They're profoundly moved by the play that they see. They're actually in tears because of what is shown of a story of injustice and suffering callously inflicted on poor people who are helpless to resist it. When the play is over, they come out of the theater. Because it's so cold, their carriage driver has been huddled there, and he didn't know when they were going to come out, so he has not swept the snow off the step of the carriage. The man flies into a rage, grabs the horsewhip, and whips the carriage driver because he has not shoveled the snow off the step into the carriage. That's given us a classic example of what is this disconnection between compassion experienced at an imaginative level, really and really felt? That's the thing we've got to get hold of. It's not just, it's really felt apparently deeply at an emotional level. In terms of the world of the imagination, you come out into the real world and you whip this guy for not sweeping the snow off the step. Emotion not carried into the real world. The problem is not with emotion. The problem is not with strong emotion. The problem is what happens to that emotion. Where is it allowed to go? How is it expressed? Is it really more self-indulgent than anything else? You see sentimental clichés that are wonderful expressions of feeling and promise and all sorts of things, but with no intention for action. I somehow identify this as unfair because someone could say this with perfect sincerity and carry it out, but I'll always be there for you. I'll always be there for you. Because I associate it with a man who said it as he was divorcing his wife, and he said that to his son, that don't worry about it, I'll always be there for you. He was not. He had no intention of always being there for him. His son went through 3 years of depression, dropped out of college, all this stuff. He had no intention of being there for him. But, I'll be there for you. I'm sure there was a feeling there. There was some sort of an intention there. Or, you mean more to me than you can ever know. Can be sincere, but can be a total sentimental cliche with going nowhere. Nothing the matter with the feelings. I'm not against feelings. I'm not against strong emotions. I'm against feelings that don't go where they're meant to go, if they're good feelings. Feelings that have no traction whatsoever, but that give great promises. Oscar Wilde, again, the sentimentalist, desires to have the luxury of an emotion without paying for it. They always try to get their emotion on credit and refuse to pay the bill when it comes in. Think of TV news. What is it designed to do? Of course it's designed to make money. But how do you make money? You make money by keeping people from changing channels. You make money only by keeping your Nielsen ratings up and having people keep watching your television news rather than anybody else's television news. How does it do that? How does it keep you from changing channels? And this is a suggestion of one of the studies I've come up with, is the TV news is, and listen to this carefully, is designed to make you feel good about yourself for feeling bad. It's designed to make you feel good about yourself for feeling bad. It's designed to engage your emotions so that you, not that you would do anything about the news, how could you possibly do anything about the news, that you feel right and good about feeling those things. You'd feel good about yourself for feeling grief, for feeling compassion, outrage, empathy, or whatever. And could it be that TV news builds itself around feelings of satisfaction about myself for feeling compassion about the victims of murder, assassination, flood, earthquake, much more than it actually encourages concern or action for people who are hurt. Admittedly, that's given the scope of television news and our limitation, that's a very hard call. Neil Postman said some years ago, the only thing we ever do anything about in the news is the weather report. Yeah. Now, we can see this aspect of sentimentality identifies, exposed, skewered in all sorts of places in the Bible. It's no good to speak and feel lovely platitudes and cliches about love, service, compassion, sensitivity, suffering, pity, justice, and beauty, but do nothing to pursue these things. And the Bible is all over it. I think of 1 John 3:18, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action. Truth and action. Love does not exist just in words. Or one of the most important verses to me in the Bible about sentimentality is James chapter 2, verse 15 to 17. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill, and yet you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? And James says, well, faith is dead. You see, it's possible here. And James is all over this, just the distinctions that I've made. It's possible to have wonderful sentiments of compassion for other people, of peace, of warmth, of goodwill, but do absolutely nothing for them, even when it is in your power. And he nails sentimentality on all three counts here. One, it's not taking the evil of another person's suffering seriously enough. It's somehow just leaving that in some imaginative space. It's being side with your own warm response. You know, peace. Keep warm. Eat your fill. It's being happy with your own compassion here. But then thirdly, it's doing nothing. It's letting the person go away, distraught and confused. And so James says it's dead faith. So I just wanted to point out that one verse in James nails all three of these categories of sentimentality that I've mentioned. So you have a real collision here. The defining characteristics of sentimentality are really against the whole character of the Christian faith as lived out. The denial of evil, the self-referential emotion, and the refusal to reach out in action. It's a profound portrayal of the Christian faith. And yet, the depth of this denial we usually don't see because sentimentality is all about niceness. We're ill-equipped to even notice all this because it's all about being nice. It's all about exuding feelings of niceness. And I think that is dangerous for that reason. So I'll just reiterate some of the apologetic issues involved here. So far as, insofar as sentimentality has invaded our space and we have been seduced by it, we set ourselves up as being examples of sentimentality. The church as even possibly a propagator of sentimentality. And people who are really honest and looking for truth and have experienced evil and want to be honest about evil as well will say, these people have no integrity. These people are playing a comfortable little game with God as their crutch. And I won't look there. Why should I look there? So it encourages some of the most destructive cynicism. The second challenge is for non-Christians who are sentimental, they need the gospel, but they, in sentimentality, have a barrier or a system of barriers that keeps them from seeing their need for the radicalness of the gospel. And that's another kind of challenge to Christian apologetics, which I'll really turn to now. So when Christianity is seduced by sentimentalism, where do we go? And what ought to be the case, of course, is the Christian church would be an oasis in the world, where one place where you wouldn't find sentimentality of the sort that I've described here. It ought to be an oasis, a place where you can take refuge from it and find refuge. Unhappily, that's really not true. I'll give you just a couple of examples. One interesting editorial I came across is entitled, How to Create Cynics. I'll read you some pieces of it. One of the greatest causes of cynicism among Christians, and this is among Christians, it would easily include non-Christians as well. Among Christians is the way we lather God talk over our lives in order to obscure realities we can see painful to discuss directly. So this is all about speech. Consider the example from church life, though such situations are not confined to local churches. A minister is not happy in his place of service. He wonders whether he was right in accepting this call in the first place. He has dealt with painful personality conflicts, constant power struggles, and criticism. Now he is leaving. He is leaving because he can't take it anymore. His future is most uncertain. But he believes he can't say any of these things. There's an unwritten code in the church, and not just in this church, that dictates how a minister says goodbye. So he says, God spoke to me and is leading me to a different place of service at this time. I appreciate the opportunity to be your pastor. Now I must move on to wherever God leads me next. Everybody in the inside of the situation knows what these words really mean. They mean, I am miserable here. I can't take it anymore. At this point, I would rather be unemployed than continue to serve here. I'm not sure exactly where God is in all of this, but in any case, I must move on. I sure wish you would deal with the issues that have led me to this point, but I won't tell you what those are, so I doubt that you will actually deal with them. Now, that's a lot to think about there. Goes on. There are several reasons most of us don't feel comfortable speaking directly about our confusion. One is that we feel we want greater certainty about life and our decisions than we often feel. We want to be able to say that we are certain that God has led us in such and such direction, now he's leading us in another direction. To articulate uncertainty seems to communicate a lack of confidence in God. Christians also do not like telling the truth about conflict. These divisions are the divisions that open up in our relationships. And our churches embarrass us. We think they should not occur. Perhaps we don't want to shake the faith of younger Christians by admitting that we should could not just work out our differences. And so we paper over such conflicts with code talk about God leading us someplace else. Well, you know, that really gets home. Many of us find that strange and something we've never experienced. You see, there's a real issue here. He's never used the word sentimentality, but it's all about sentimentality. How do you create cynics? Be sentimental. The apologetic problem here is that Christians people suspect that Christians are being dishonest. They're right. And what is the deal if Christian people can't talk about sin? We're meant to be the people who believe in sin and even persuade other people to believe in sin. If we don't believe in sin or live in a way that gives any indication that we believe in sin, how do we expect people to believe in sin? Self-reference is a very dangerous ground for sliding into cynicism from a different direction also. I think of D.H. Lawrence's claim that we tend to fake the feelings we wish were real. We don't have the real feelings, but we want them, so we fake them, and that the world is all gummy with them. Here again, I may get into trouble, but do you think that sometimes, every once in a great while, you may have witnessed faked feelings of worship? Do you think you may have seen, or maybe even done yourself, faked feelings of intimacy with God? There's such a danger, I think, because in evangelical faith there's such an emphasis on our intimacy with God, but perhaps too narrowly on my walk with God. Reality is me and God, and the intimacy of this walk with God. Christian literature and contemporary music. I just ask you to think of what you know about contemporary Christian music. And how this can feed the very thing. I don't take this in a lump. It's obviously enormously diverse, but filled with glowing descriptions of life-changing encounters and of this great presence of God with me, with us. But I think this huge Christian overspeak here in much of our experience. I feel the need to caution. Let's make sure that we keep it real. Nobody is fooling God, and if it's not real, it's really hurting other people because they'll be deceived and it's hurting us. If I had time, I'd talk about Christian non-engagement in society, an expression outward of our good Christian feelings. There's a tremendous way, and we've touched on this already, in which if we're stuck in a sacred secular world, we're caught in our Christian tribe and we never get out into the world. I don't want to go far on that because there's been a lot of very helpful change just in the last 30 years. So I don't want to be down in the mouth at all there, because things are happening that I wouldn't have dreamed could happen even 30 years ago. But that is a huge area, too, to think, okay, how do we take our faith and live it out and express it into the world? In terms of apologetic to sentimental people, I'll just reflect on a couple of things here. First of all, we need to see how far the basic sentimental impulse is from the real gospel. The idea of see no evil basically sidesteps the whole Christian diagnosis of the human problem, which says the world is broken, you are broken, society is broken. It's in desperate need for God's mercy and God's transforming power. When sin is denied or trivialized or euphemized or evil, the basic fabric of Christian theology of the positive side becomes, to the degree to which it's sort of euphemized or whatever, the basic fabric of Christian theology becomes to that degree irrelevant. You see, sin is the problem which Jesus came as the solution with his death and resurrection. What happens if you no longer see sin to be an urgent, extremely difficult problem? You have a solution, but isn't really needed. You have a solution that's more or less irrelevant. you have a solution, especially because it's, in today's discussion, kind of gory and crude, an embarrassment. The cross, the atonement, has become an embarrassment. It's so negative, it's so barbaric. Who needs it? And anyway, the salvation Jesus brings seems only to be sort of an optional salvation for people who feel like they need it. I remember a discussion that I've often quoted, actually, of a guy who came to study with us in Lebrean, Massachusetts. He said, "I didn't ask Jesus to die for me. I think that's highly manipulative." And I had to say, you know, you're absolutely right if it isn't a problem. If sin isn't a problem, what is this "I'll die for you" business? What do you want someone to die for you for if you don't need it? It probably just calls you post-traumatic stress, and you'll need counseling, you know. Unless you needed that, unless you were in front of the truck and he had to get you out of the front of the truck and it was a self-sacrificial act, then you can understand it, sure. But that's just what is excluded by this. And so you talk about the meaningfulness of, or you doubt and push to the side the importance of the Christian diagnosis, and you also just completely unhinge the Christian solution, which is totally, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons why belief in Jesus as the only way to the one God is such an outrage to people today, because it just doesn't make sense to them. Well, it wouldn't make sense, and it can't make sense if sin, in their mind, isn't the problem. We mustn't be surprised by people outraged by the claims of the uniqueness of Christ. It's not going to make sense. It can't possibly make sense to them unless sin and evil are really biblical in a biblical way. You see the same about self-referential emotion. If we are the center of our lives and our emotional life is the center of my existence, it misses the importance of a huge God-created universe out there that God takes very, very seriously. He made it, after all. We use the phrase sometimes people who come and have no sense of other. A person who has no sense of other. By that, we mean everything they experience is seen in terms of its impact on them. So they may, of course, see the world, see people, and so on, but it's processed so that the only thing that's important is what is its impact on me? How does it make me feel? One example, a friend totals his car. Response, "Oh, what a bummer. I was going to borrow that car next weekend." You know, there's a big world out there that God cares about with a lot of people, a lot of things going on, and he's put us in it able to understand that, able to interact with it. It's a real world, and it exists outside of your head. And it is made by God, and it is real, and it is solid, and it will push back if you ignore it. It will push back if we ignore its givenness and what is found in it. Sentimentality, though, can filter out an enormous amount. If it's going strong, it can filter out all our difficult feelings of anxiety, fear, guilt, shame, alienation, loneliness, meaninglessness that might be coming from God, that God is pushing at us because we're trying to live without him or trying to live building our lives around idols or whatever. Any need to change or feeling of need to change, sentimentality can domesticate, can homogenize and bring distraction to them. I think Jesus has experienced it. Well, I start first here with the example of Ezekiel. Remember God telling Ezekiel, "You've got to go and prophesy to the nation. You've got to tell them some really bad stuff. And I've got even worse news for you. When they hear you, they're going to hear you as a crooner of love songs. They're not going to pay the slightest attention. You're going to talk to them about the message of the destruction of their whole nation. But they're going to hear you as, oh, this is such a well-known singer. Isn't it fun that we can get to hear him?" God warns Ezekiel of this. Jesus gets a similar treatment when he goes to his hometown in Nazareth in Luke 4, early in his ministry. He's had some sort of a reputation in Jerusalem. They've heard he's a leader. He's done healing. He's been saying extraordinary things. He comes back to his hometown synagogue on his first sort of appearance after he started to make waves in the world. And he reads this passage from Isaiah that says, hey, the Messiah is here. And he says, this has been fulfilled in your hearing. And what he's saying is, this is it. I am the long-awaited one. I am it. I am here. Right now in your presence. And you might have thought, I would have thought, there might have been two responses. One, man, if this is true, we're with you. What do we do? Tell us where to go. Tell us what to do. We're standing with you. Praise God that this happened. Or, no, you're not. We know you. You're just the son of Joseph. We knew you as a kid kicking sand around in the streets. No, we don't want to believe that. Both those would be expected responses to the claims that he made. Acceptance or rejection. But what did he get? What did he get? He has such a nice way with words. He's so well spoken. That's what he got. You read the Bible, it's all there in Luke. They get sentimentalism. Nothing, no connection with these absolutely earth-shaking claims that he's just made that have huge demands on them. And then he pushed, and he pushed, and he pushed through their sentimentality. When he finally pushed through their sentimentality, they flipped through town and tried to throw him off a cliff. So he finally did make it through, at least. But it gives you an idea of how precious their sentimental version of the whole thing was. Place of contact. How do we? I think many sentimental people are at least appear to be out of reach of much of what we want to have them hear. But a reality that is denied pushes back. We must be aware, and I think this is, as Christians, trying to spend time with people like this, we must be really sensitive to where reality is pushing back. Dr. Schaefer's whole apologetic is be sensitive to where reality is pushing back on unbelief. You're not a believer. You're living not in the world that is really there. And you have a different understanding of it, and reality will push back and impede and restrict that what you do believe. We need to be sensitive to that and help people to see it, help people to recognize it for what it is. The brokenness of the world confronts us all, even through our attempts to silence it. Reality does not lie down and adapt to our self-deceptions. We can, I think people very often start to worry about God and start to ask big questions, really when they get this sort of pushback. We had a men's retreat in our church, and we just went around the whole room to ask, what was it that brought you to a place of really taking God seriously in your life? And for many of them, it had been in midlife or in adulthood, and almost every one, it had some association with death or divorce. Now, those are not sentimental things. Those are not things that sentimentality has a lot to look at directly. Those are also profoundly unplanned events. But death and divorce somehow forced their way through and into the world where these guys had to say, I've got to deal with this. I've got to face this. I've got to look at life in a very different way. So God's reality brings checks, reality checks to us. The world's brokenness and our own brokenness breaks through. For the prodigal son didn't just get tired of it in a far land and come to himself and come home. He got bankrupt and starving in a far land and decided to come home. It takes a lot to undo our idols, often to make us pick up and come home. There's another angle that I've experienced just among our students. There's a realization that perhaps in the midst of all this, and this is a huge issue today, and I'd love to do more work on it, but perhaps I have become a shallow person. There's a New England poet, more known, but a guy called David McCord, who's written a lot of different sorts of poetry. One of his lines, written about someone of whom he did not have great respect, was this: very simple. Deep down, he is very shallow. What an amazing thing to say about somebody. Deep down, he is very shallow. Deep down, there's no depth to us. Go as deep as you want, and you still get shallowness, superficiality, self-preoccupation, vanity, triviality, self-indulgence. This is exactly what sentimentality does to us. This is the cost. This is the one of the costs, at least. If we won't engage in the unpleasant, in the upsetting, in the suffering of life, this is what it does. If we avoid life's complexity and confusion, this is what it does. If we can't face pain in ourselves and others, this is what it does. If what we feel most deeply is really what we're feeling ourselves, is about ourselves, rather, we're already very deep. Yes. Jesus, I think, shows us two choices, in what I would call a malattitude, and in the other, in his well-known beatitude. He said, you can choose to laugh now and try to keep on laughing, but he predicted that would end in mourning and weeping. Or you can mourn now. Mourn the brokenness of the world, of yourself and the world. Work against it in ourselves and others and in the world with God's help. But then the strange, strange truth of his beatitude is that those who mourn will be comforted, fulfilled, blessed. And I just want to reflect a little bit on this, because I think it's important to get this to be really tangible about the impact of a life lived in the sentimental bubble and what it actually does to us. What sort of a person do we become if we deny and trivialize our own sin? We become self-righteous, pompous, self-satisfied, self-deceived, and probably fearful. What sort of person do we become if we deny or trivialize our own suffering, our own anxiety, depression, anger, sense of inferiority, inadequacy? We become a fake. We become hollow. We become phony. And we are very afraid of discovery. What sort of a person do we become if we don't relate to other people in their suffering? Now, let me quickly say that is very costly to relate to other people in their suffering. That takes a lot of time and a lot of energy that we don't have. It's also sometimes embarrassing. It's also sometimes extremely difficult, bearing huge loads with them that you don't think you can bear. It's easy to see why we want to avoid other people in their suffering. But what do we become? We become more selfish, shallow, and superficial, and phony in our own concerns. Donald McCulloch wrote, the stampede toward entertainment begins so with the flight from sorrow. Interesting. Stampede toward entertainment begins with the flight from sorrow. That can be your sorrow or others. What if your most important relationship is with your TV set or with the internet? What sort of a person do we become if we don't honestly confront conflict with other people? We want to keep a happy face on things, especially have everybody happy with us who lives near us and who's around us. We become very fearful people, fearing the conflicts that we can't avoid. But we set ourselves up, if we do this, we're setting ourselves up for worse conflicts because we haven't faced them yet. And they accumulate, they get bigger, they snowball on us. And then they come at us when we can't possibly avoid them. We also become people who end up moving a lot, socially or even geographically. As conflict looms, away we go. These are some of the areas that I'm trying to make concrete, the idea if we give in to this and we're drawn into the sentimentality, this is really what happens to it. There's a huge cost here. There's a huge cost in humanness. And what I'm arguing here, and this is why this isn't just on the Christian life, but it's also got to do with apologetics. People don't want this. Nobody wants that. This isn't something that's attractive to be a shallow person. It's not something that you lift up to be someone who's heroic for their shallowness. No, something that we find aversive. But we need to make this connection. We need to help people make this connection with what they have allowed of the brokenness of the world into their life and help them try to understand it. People don't want to be this way. But I've found a real traction in lots of people who see this as a real danger, and then will back up and have a different look. So finally here, what I've just to summarize, what I've talked about in sentimentality is a subject that I don't think gets enough attention from Christians, because I think it's much more of a factor than we realize, but it's really a powerful player in our midst, and certainly all over the place in modern America. Its apologetics significance cuts both ways, as I've said. If people are sentimental enough, they will realize that they don't really need Christ and all that Christ has come to offer, and it will seem to them just an optional salvation for some people who are particularly gloomy. It also keeps real seekers away, keeps people who are really sincerely searching away if they're able to look at the Christian faith, to look at the Christian community and say, ah, these people have no integrity. These people are just trying to be comfortable and let the world go past and are unengaged with it. This is a huge place where I think non-Christians look at the Christian church and they say, where are you on the really critical issues of justice, of inequality, of all sorts of tremendously powerful issues of pain and suffering in the world today? Where are you? Well, we're a lot better than we were 30 years ago, but there's still a long way to go. See, the Christian faith makes a terrible diagnosis, but offers a magnificent hope. And we can't expect to fast forward to the hope without taking measure of the diagnosis. We can't expect to skip over the diagnosis and its reality and the fact that we're living in this reality daily and just lay a hold of the hope. Again, Jesus, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I think that says a lot into this discussion. I'll end there, and I hope I'm not too far over the mark.
Thank you again for listening to this chapel message from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you are thinking about theological education on the undergraduate or graduate level, including doctoral studies, we hope that you consider us. If you also find these chapel messages encouraging and a blessing to your walk with Christ, we hope that you will consider financially supporting Southeastern. Our graduates are literally serving the kingdom across this globe, working to carry the gospel of Jesus Christ to a lost, dying world. Your gifts will help to train more, and they will serve as a worthwhile investment in God's kingdom. You can find more information about attending Southeastern or supporting us financially at www.sebts.edu. We covet your prayers and trust that God will bless every good work you do for His glory. Thank you for joining us in our chapel services.